Good morning. Welcome to our meeting this morning to discuss housing issues that affect people with disabilities. We have a full agenda this morning. I'm sure most of you have picked it up if I haven't had fun. So we're going to be moving along, trying to keep the testifiers on a time limit here today, because last month we had some excellent testimony, but by the time we got towards the end of it, we had many people that ended up they couldn't stay. So I would like today for us to be able to move along. So Jen here, I'm asking that you try to keep me. For those of you that know me, that's a very difficult task I'm asking, to keep us on target here this morning and move us along. So what we're going to be talking about today, this happens to be a very interesting week for us to be holding this hearing. Again, it just happened to coincide with a lot of things happening in the community. Last night I was at a housing event dealing with affordable housing and discussing the statistics here in Minnesota and in particular our metro area here and our need being at this point over 100,000 new units are necessary of affordable housing for us to just be able to house the people that currently are house burdened or at the brink of becoming homeless. So if we're looking at numbers like that, I'm very interested this morning to hear what our numbers are looking like for the disabilities community. For those of you, again, just my personal perspective on this, I have a daughter with spina bifida, and I was put in the situation where I had to modify my home. We ended up having to put in an elevator, and we had to make modifications to our floor plan, and those expenses, when they are caught by a family that is unprepared to absorb that, can be enough to force you out of your home. So my interest in this is finding out what we're doing to deal with that, because I don't think this is a new problem, and I'm hoping that the testifiers today are telling me that we have finally decided that we're going to put some effort into this area. And I'm also hoping that we're able to get some perspective on this of what our future is going to be looking like and what we need to do to secure our future for housing for people with disabilities. So with that, we will, again, I just would like to say good morning to my fellow committee members. Good morning. Good morning, Representative Bigham and Representative Anderson. And why don't we move to our first testifier, who is Ann Henry.
Good morning. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We are part of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis, and we represent people with long-term and sometimes permanent disabilities across the state, children and adults. This morning, I'm going to take a brief time to give an overview and a context about the Olmstead Supreme Court decision, and I took the liberty to back up even from that to try to set the stage for thinking about housing issues and people with disabilities. First of all, I think when we're dealing with this topic, it's important to realize that we have a whole variety of state and federal laws that define disabilities, and not every person qualifies for every single law or program. Some people can qualify for one and not another. So in thinking about this, it's always important to look behind the name of the program to what the definition is. And in order to underscore that, I included some data on the numbers of people with disabilities in various programs in Minnesota. We actually did this for another purpose, but I thought it would at least help emphasize the idea that there are different definitions and there are different numbers of people in various categories. And let me just say that when I did this, I noticed last night that some of the two data points dropped off, so I just want to mention them. Would have been number, after the Home and Community Services, number 8 would have been mental health conditions. And the National Institute of Mental Health has a figure of 26% of the population prevalence rate at any one time have a diagnosable mental health condition over the course of a year. And they also say that 6% of our population has a serious mental illness. And the other data point involves people who are deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind, and that rate was 8.5% in total. And again, those are people who may have that condition from birth or childhood, plus those who are losing their hearing as a result of aging. And I think in terms of the Olmsted Supreme Court case, the important information here is number 6 under medical assistance, because that's the program that pays for the services that the two women in the Olmsted Supreme Court decision needed. Medical assistance pays for residential services in the community and institutional services. And we have about 95,000 people with disabilities, and the Medicaid program requires those people who qualify for that to be under 65. If you happen to have a disability but you're over 65, you're automatically put into the elderly or aging category. This is the way they do it. Also, by way of overview, I think it's important to keep in mind that we have a number of important laws that prohibit discrimination based on disability. Going back to 1973, we have Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. We have also 1973, our own Minnesota Human Rights Act, which then was amended in 1989 to include a requirement that reasonable modifications can be made by a person with a disability. We also have a very important Federal Fair Housing Act, a civil rights law, and discrimination, in their terms, based on handicap, was added in 1988. And then the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was adopted in 1990, a very important civil rights act for people with disabilities. And finally, we get to the Olmsted Supreme Court decision in 1999. Now, that case was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, finding that unnecessary segregation of individuals with disabilities in institutions may cause discrimination based on disability. It was really it was a watershed decision. Olmsted is based on the Americans with Disabilities Act, again, a broad civil rights act, which prohibits discrimination against persons with disabilities in both public and private entities. And it requires reasonable accommodations that must be made for people with disabilities in many different kinds of settings to allow people with disabilities to participate in the regular life of our society. The ADA also requires adequate access be provided in public buildings and programs. The key aspect of the ADA that was used in the Olmsted case and that has had a very positive impact since is in the regulations, and it's called the integration mandate. And it says that a public entity shall administer services and programs and activities in the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of the qualified individuals with disabilities. So back to the Olmsted case, we had two women, LC and EW, who had both a diagnosis of mental illness and mental retardation. They were institutionalized in a state institution in Georgia, a psychiatric state institution, and they wanted to live in the community and receive services in the community, and the professionals treating them thought that was a good idea, that they could do so. But the problem was that the state had a very long waiting list for a few community placements. The state of Georgia at that point really had their money and services in institutions. So these two women were unnecessarily institutionalized for many years. A suit was brought on their behalf claiming that the state of Georgia violated the ADA integration mandate, again saying that people should live in the most integrated setting possible, and that the state of Georgia had failed to provide those services in the most integrated setting possible, appropriate to their needs. The two women happily won their case, and that Supreme Court victory ultimately led to them being able to move out and receive community-based housing, training programs, and employment. Now, the Olmstead case focused on the rights of these two people, and it was against the state because of the way they structured their funding and services. This was involved state institutions in Georgia, but nursing homes also can qualify as institutions and are certainly not always the most integrated setting, often not. For people with disabilities who want to live in the community, being in a nursing home is a situation very similar to those two women in the Olmstead case. And again, the court decided that unjustified isolation is properly regarded as discrimination on the basis of disability under the ADA. And clearly, Congress did intend that law, the ADA, to step up our efforts to allow people with disabilities to fully participate in all aspects of our community. The upshot is that the ADA can require states to make reasonable accommodations to its programs and services to provide community-based services rather than relying on old-line institutions. And of course, in Minnesota, we have a long history of working on getting people out of institutions. There is a two-part test in the Olmstead case to decide if a person is qualified to get out. One is, do the treating professionals find the person can be appropriately served in the community? And other is, does the person want to leave? And we find in the clients that we represent in our office, those two requirements are very, very often present. I suppose people aren't coming to our office unless they want help to live in the community. But certainly in terms of that professional question, can people live in the community, we've answered that in the affirmative time and again in Minnesota. There are limits on the state's obligations. One is a fundamental alteration defense, and the second is, does the state have a comprehensive, effectively working plan to move toward most integrated setting for people? And that has been certainly under discussion in Minnesota, and would be an interesting question, I think, to ask our state. Certainly in developmental disabilities, we have closed, for the most part, our state institutions with one program left, the Minnesota Extended Treatment Option at Cambridge. And I think it would be fair to say in mental health, we are certainly moving in that direction. The issue of people in nursing facilities, I think the state has certainly made efforts, but I think you'll hear more later from other testifiers that we have a long way to go.
Ms. Henry, can you explain what fundamental alteration defense is? What is that?
A fundamental alteration would mean if you have a program set up to do something and a person with a disability asks that you do something else, is it so fundamental that it changes the entire nature of a program or changes the manner in which the state is doing something? It's extremely fact-specific, and it really depends on the state that you're in, but I think suffice it to say that Georgia wasn't successful in this case because they were paying for support services for two women to live, but it was in an institution, and it was not a fundamental alteration for them to beef up their community side. They already had some community services, and so the integration mandate really led to the decision that Georgia had to make changes. I'm going to conclude now just leaving you with two major problems, and I think you'll probably hear more about them today and as we move forward. One is the availability of affordable, accessible housing. People with disabilities have a very high rate of unemployment, a very high rate of poverty, and of course, in order to get support services from the medical assistance or Medicaid program, that program requires impoverishment unless you can qualify for medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. So affordability is a very significant problem for a lot of people. And again, if you remember the data at the beginning, some people with disabilities don't need those support services to live in a home or apartment. They might need medical assistance, though, for their health care. They might just need affordability and accessibility. And let me just put in a plug on the affordability issue. The legislature did have before it legislation to provide a shelter needy housing subsidy last session, which was not adopted, unfortunately. But that would be very helpful to people who do have to impoverish themselves because they need services under medical assistance. It would have allowed an extra $152 a month for folks. And I think the fiscal note on that was in the range of $900,000 for the biennium. So it is, does not have a very large price tag, but could do a lot of good. And I think that you do have a handout on that from ARC Minnesota called Shelter Needy Housing Supplement. The other issue is, of course, accessibility, and we'll hear more about that. The second big issue I want to just leave you with is the waiting list for services in developmental disabilities. We had 5 years, basically, of drought and freeze when the budget was in such trouble from 2002 until last year, and we're still waiting for new resources on that program, but we have a waiting list now of over 5,000 people. The new resources to come are going to be funding for 300 people in each January of the biennium we're in right now. Really, unfortunately, a drop in the bucket. Gratefully, the other disability waiver programs, the CADI program for people who would otherwise be in nursing homes, the TBI program for people with traumatic brain injury, and the CAC program for people at a hospital level of care, the CADI and TBI program had their caseload limits lifted, and so there should not be waiting lists for services, but we do find people who need those kinds of services need affordable, accessible housing, and that is their problem. So with that, I'll conclude, and you'll hear from other people more information about these issues.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions from the committee members? No? All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Henry.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Eva Hansen.
Good morning, and if you can identify yourself for the recording.
Certainly, I'm Ann Ross, so I'm the coordinator of Options 2, working with nursing home relocation. And this is my colleague, Eva Hansen, who is the manager of nursing home relocation at the Metro Center for Independent Living. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Options 2, which is an effort to, I do have handouts.
And Ms. Hansen, do you actually have copies of the DHS report, the actual report?
Yes. I have final summary copies for the committee, and they're more up on top if somebody else wants copies.
Thank you.
So, as I mentioned, I'm Ann Roscoe with Options 2. And Ann Henry has already gone over the Olmstead decision, which mandates that people living in institutions need to live in the least restrictive environment possible. And as she mentioned, also Minnesota has made a number of efforts in this area. In 2005, a committee was formed. An Options 2 work group was formed as a result of legislative action and instructed to make recommendations regarding nursing home relocation. The work group included disability advocates, disability-related nonprofits, and government agencies. Earlier this year, the Options 2 final report was sent to the legislature, and I've given you copies of that. The work group is still active with the Metropolitan Council for Independent Living and the Minnesota State Council on Disability taking the lead in collaborating on efforts to implement the recommendations made by the committee. The work group identified 5 major areas of concern. Of course, one of those is housing. Finding appropriate, affordable, and accessible housing with community services for people with disabilities is a statewide issue, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that this morning. In March of this year, there were approximately 6,000 Minnesotans of all ages who wanted to relocate from nursing homes. And now I'm going to turn the mic over to Eva Hansen, who will tell you about MCIL's nursing home relocation program and about one individual who wants to relocate.
Good morning. As Ann mentioned, I am Eva Hansen. I'm
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
I'm Eva Hansen. I'm the manager of MCIL's Nursing Home Relocation Program. And since
2001, MCI has relocated 115 people back into the community. So far this year, we've relocated 18 people. Finding housing is always a challenge because of the needs of consumers, community support in regards to transportation, accessibility, and affordability. I would like to tell you this morning about Tom, a 39-year-old man with multiple disabilities. He had one leg amputated about a year ago and lives with Crohn's disease and depression. Although Tom has many health issues, he tries to spend as much time with his 5-year-old son, who lives in the Bloomington area. Since Tom now lives in a nursing home, he is not able to see his son as often as he would like. He would like to live in the Bloomington area as well. The problem with this situation is finding housing that will meet Tom's needs and locating something in the area of town he chooses to live in. That's a big important piece. Tom insists on living with his son. Problem is that there's no housing options in the Bloomington area. This has made it very difficult to locate any housing for him. The other side of this problem is that Tom's 180 calendar days of relocation services, RSC, has ended. This means he is no longer eligible to have RSC assist him in locating housing. So Tom will likely stay in the nursing home until his name comes up on a very long waiting list for assisted living housing. Tom is a young man and needs to be with his family. It is so very sad that someone like Tom will be in the nursing home until something comes up for him. I would like to thank you, Madam Chair, and the work group this morning for allowing us to take the time to talk with you about this issue. And we are happy to answer any questions you may have.
5-1, I'm wondering if you can explain for the committee members and also for the audience what relocation service coordination, what is that?
Relocation service coordination is a program that is designed to assist the consumer on a direct individual basis, on a one-on-one basis, to assist the consumer in locating housing, setting up services, coordinating all of their cares and services once they're in the community, locating furniture, every aspect that one would need to relocate back into the community, coordinating the move day, actually physically moving items from their nursing home back into their new home or into the community, and the whole realm of setting up every piece of service that someone might need in the community. And it's very individualized by consumer.
And can you explain to me what the 180 days have to do with that?
The 180 days is a federal mandate that states that we, as relocation coordinators, have exactly 180 days to move somebody from a licensed setting back into the community. And in the problem with that is there is, it's usually the last 180 days of somebody's stay, which is what it should be. But with the housing issue as it is, it means that it's very difficult for us at times to find housing for someone like Tom, who is very specific on where he wants to be, is unable to move forward because the housing options just aren't going to be there because the waiting list is so long, his 180 days are going to run out and have.
And I think we need to mention those are 180 calendar days, including weekends and holidays. So in the 180 days, we lose approximately 50 days.
So what I'm trying to understand again for the committee and the audience members is what you're telling me is when somebody enters a facility, when does the clock start the 180 days? Is it the first day of admission? Is it?
The clock starts usually with the 180 days when somebody has actually went up to their, and it sounds kind of silly, but if they go up to their nursing home social worker and say, you know, I really don't want to be here. So, and then what happens is a referral is made to the county, and then when the county comes out and does a screen, and then the referral process then comes down to contacted vendors like myself. And what happens is once we go out and see the person at that time, depending on their health issues. If, you know, like say they're going to have surgery or something, then we're not going to start that intake process until after they're well enough to go back into the community. But once we've actually started working with them, the intake is done, we've set up our times to work with them, that's when that 180-day clock should start. However, it doesn't always start like that, because when the county goes out and does their intake process, their screening, to see if somebody can move out into the community, the county may have started that 180-day clock. So by the time I get the consumer and start working with them, my clock may even be a lot shorter than the 180 days.
I will, my next question on that then is, when we start that 180 days, we can't suspend for housing search. So you have all the community support, you have a location, but there's a 3-month or 4-month waiting list to get into that facility or that building. You can't suspend, or is there any room for movement there?
No, there is not. It is a consecutive time, and they don't allow for suspension of, it's not written into the law that to allow for suspension of the 180 days while they're waiting for housing.
What can Minnesota do about that?
We're going to refer that question to our student colleague, Dave Hansen.
I guess what I'm trying to get my arms around what you're saying. So, Madam Chair, I guess what you're asking is, if everything is in place and you have located a living facility for somebody, you're asking why can't they suspend that while you found something, and because they go on a waiting list for that facility, but not necessarily because of something that your organization has done. I mean, if you've gotten all of your ducks in a row, but yet the facility has a waiting list, you're asking why can't they suspend that?
That's correct.
Okay, I was just lost there for a second.
Thank you, Ms. Hancock.
Good morning, Madam Chair. How are you?
Hi.
David Hancock. I'm the Executive Director of the Metro Center for Independent Living. What is being referred to the 180-day, the reason that we live under that qualification is because it's federal rule. So we don't have the authority or the ability to substitute our own desires or our own calendar for that federal rule. So in other words, to the point of your question, Madam Chair, is what can Minnesota do is, well, we can certainly talk to our congressional delegation and ask them to seek a change in that 180-day rule. But short of that, I mean, it would require federal action. It's not, to my knowledge, it's not anything that we could do individually. It would require federal rule change.
Is there some better coordination we can do? Because one thing Ms. Hansen talked about was the fact that county may have started that 180-day clock before she gets the client. Is there some movement there? Is there something we can do to help streamline that so that the clock starts on the same day for everybody?
Well, Madam Chair, that would be ideal if we had that consistency across the board. Unfortunately, what happens is when you move from county to county, there are different protocols in place in each county, so there's no consistency. And they may be interpreting the federal rules or regs differently as well in the different county settings. So unfortunately, it's and again, they're following what they understand to be the federal rule.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has it been tried to intervene or go through the Senate, U.S. Senate and the House to get this rule changed, and what was the result of that?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, one of the things that we did recently, actually myself and two other Senate directors in visiting with some of our congressional delegates in Washington, D.C., we brought up this very issue. And one of the individuals, Congressman Ramstead, offered a tremendous amount of support and showed great concern for this issue and offered a willingness to work with us to pursue a change in the 180-day rule. For example, one of the things that we have suggested is that there be, when you hit up against, like the gentleman that you would describe, Tom, when you hit up against that 180 days and there are significant and real barriers to the successful relocation. Nothing to do with the relocation coordination services that provided, or certainly the consumer, it's not their fault either. Okay. It's because there's a lack of accessible affordable housing or other resources in the community that person needs to have available. that there be a 30-day extension that is qualified. It's not arbitrary just to ask for the 30 days, so that there has to be a qualified 30-day extension. We have, in talking with a couple members of Congress, they thought that was a marvelous idea. There has been some resistance to approaching Congress with this request at this point in time, and rather would there's been a suggestion that we wait until the spring when they come back from the holiday recess next spring. So there is the potential of pursuing this on the federal level, and there seems to be some degree of support, so that's a possibility.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there concern that this mischief by extending this further than 180 days? Is there something that's been found in the past in present situations where there's been abuse of the situation, or there's possibility of abuse if you were to go beyond 180 days and allow this to be made available?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I certainly don't want to speak for representatives of the federal government. I don't know what their qualifications are for the strictness of that 180 days. One could assume, one could make the assumption that that is probably part of the reason that they don't want to see it become an arbitrarily continually extended timeline, because we do, I mean, when we're performing the relocation coordination services that Ms. Hansen described, those are billable hours, and it's federal money that is involved in those billable hours, so I would assume that that is probably one of the motivations for not wanting to extend 180 days. But again, I can't speak for the federal government. That's not my role, but I would guess that that's probably part of the reason.
And then can you explain to me what this list is that Eva referred to, that he has to be put on a list, a very long waiting list? What happens, so the 180 days is up, we don't have a facility or a building or an apartment, house, anything available for this person. They're stuck in a nursing home, literally stuck. What is this waiting list that they go on?
The nursing home at that point in time, Madam Chair, the nursing home can continue their efforts, but the person is no longer qualified for the relocation coordination assistance from an organization like ours. The nursing home themselves, the staff there, can continue whatever efforts they choose to assist that person to relocate, but there's no coordination with an agency like ours, because when you hit that 180 days, it stops.
Yeah. I'm laying that at the floor. I can't do that for a minute. Representative Anderson?
Thank you. So there is no such thing as having, a two-year window in which you can apply, or 1 year, or somewhere by you could apply for this, go on the waiting list, and at the end of a certain length of time, okay, you lost your eligibility, but now that say 2 years, could it be 2 years that Congress would be in session of the biennium? So, can they reapply for this again?
For relocation services, somebody certainly can apply for RSC services again. In lies the problem, if they're going to, the eligibility criteria for the 180-day relocation is that someone has to be currently in a facility. But you can't transfer from one facility to the other and have relocation start all over again. Relocation has to start only when a person has discharged from the nursing home, been out in the community for at least 24 hours, and then be readmitted into a facility again. Then they're eligible for the 180-day clock to start again.
I don't know what to say. Anybody else have a question on this? So, physically, we have to put somebody out of the facility for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Physically out of the facility.
Yes.
Then bring them back to the facility.
Madam Chair,
bring them back to a new facility.
Right.
Madam Chair, if I may, though, it's not just being absent from the nursing home for 24 hours. They have to be discharged. So, I mean, it's not like going away for a weekend and coming back. You have to actually be discharged from the nursing home and then readmitted.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, if I might also, a brief comment that I had with Ann, the point that's made also is that even if we were able to work with Congress to get qualifications for extensions of the 180-day rule, that even extending that 180-day by 30-day increments with qualifications, doesn't really change the fact that there isn't accessible and affordable housing or other
right.
supportive resources that are necessary and available in the community.
Madam Chair and community members, I'd like to also qualify all of this by saying we try to move consumers where they want to live,
yes.
as any of us would want to live where we want to live. So it's, there's a that's an additional limitation, but it's certainly understandable.
Madam Chair, to justify this, how many people are in this category where they've gone through this situation and after a while they just say, it doesn't work, why should I even bother doing this because the system isn't helping?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have that data with me this morning. I'm sure that it is available from the Department of Human Services because they do track that data pretty specifically, so they would be able to tell you that. The other thing that I would point out, if I may, just as a sidebar, is the Center for Independent Living, not just the Metro Center, but the other seven centers for independent living around the state of Minnesota are very, very actively engaged. It's kind of become our fifth core service, if you will, is nursing home relocation. We work very intensely with local communities to assist in the nursing home relocation. We've been able to track for the last 5 years the number of individuals that we not only physically assist, as Ms. Hansen has described it, we physically assist to move from a nursing home or another institutional setting into the community, but also the number of individuals that, because of our services, their out-of-home placement is prevented. And we've been able to track a savings to the state of Minnesota between $6 and $9 million a year by preventing those out-of-home placements using Department of Human Services data and inserting our numbers into that formula. We save the state of Minnesota between $6 and $9 million a year in out-of-home placements. So there's a cost savings issue here as well, not just certainly a quality of life issue, but also a cost savings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The situation here looks like that it's a father and a family that was split up, and the mother has got the 5-year-old child, lives in Bloomington, and that's where she wants to live. My question is, if the mother and the child were to move closer to him in a type of a situation, reverse the situation, and there was, say, a facility available closer to him that would work out, and she would be amenable to that, meaning that the city separated, but I mean the fact that the son would be closer to the child, to the father, is that a possibility under this Relocation Services Act?
We have explored that very possibility, but the mother and father of this particular 5-year-old son are apart, and she owns her own home, and they don't really have a lot of contact. It's mainly for the son that he has a lot of contact. So for him in this situation, that wouldn't work. I would love to see it work.
Well, I've just gotten a little pat here that we need to move on from this. I will definitely be speaking to you in more detail about this, and I appreciate your coming in this morning and starting to give us a picture of what this looks like. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bingham says it's a little messy. I would absolutely concur with that. So we are moving on to supportive and traditional housing, and Jennifer Hope. Good morning,
Madam Chair and members of the working group. My name is Jennifer Hope, and I'm the executive director of a nonprofit called House Connections. The focus of this presentation today is housing people with multiple behavioral, medical, and physical disabilities who also have long histories of homelessness. Let me get this going right here. This pretty graph tells an ugly truth. The Wilder Research Center conducts a point-in-time survey one night every 3 years on the number of people who are homeless. And what you see is in 2006, they counted 7,713 people who were living in shelters on the streets and in transitional housing, 2.5 times the number of people counted in 1991. While they uses the count to estimate the number of Minnesotans homeless on any given night, approximately 9,200 Minnesotans. From their report, I quote, "The proportions of people with mental health problems, substance abuse problems, traumatic brain injury, and other disabilities continues to increase. For example, in 2006, over half, 52% of homeless adults and 54% of homeless youth 17 and younger report a recent diagnosis or treatment for a serious mental illness. People who are homeless have many different disabilities. Greg Owen from the Wilder Research Center, let me steal his slide, so I'm grateful to him for these. What you see in this slide is that of the adults, of all homeless adults who are surveyed, only 28% of them didn't report a serious mental illness, a chronic health condition, or a substance abuse disorder. And the remainder, yes, they have a very large group of people who have multiple conditions. In fact, 12% of the people who were surveyed report having all three, a serious mental illness, a chronic health condition, and a substance abuse disorder. Now, 44% of homeless adults reported at least one chronic health problem, including asthma or another chronic lung or respiratory problem, including tuberculosis, high blood pressure, diabetes, chronic cardiovascular problems, hepatitis, HIV or AIDS. So it's a lot of challenges that people who are homeless face. Wilder writes, 41% reported that they had a physical, mental, or other health condition that limited the kind or amount of work that they could do. 15% had a condition that makes it hard to engage in activities of daily living. 33% often feel confused, have trouble remembering things, or have problems making decisions to the point that it interferes with daily activities. 30% had received a blow to the head hard enough to knock them out or make them see stars, followed by problems with headaches, concentration or memory, understanding, excessive worry, sleeping, or getting along with people, an indication of possible traumatic brain injury. People experiencing homelessness have many disabilities. That's who we were set up to help. Fast Connection manages a network of supportive housing providers through three regional long-term homeless projects in northeastern, in southeastern and south central Minnesota, and the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Our goal is to help people with long histories of homelessness and multiple barriers to stable housing, including many co-occurring disabilities, get and keep permanent housing, and use housing as the foundation for improved health and well-being. 1,093 people participate in our programs today, including 197 families with 461 kids, 326 single adults, and 35 unaccompanied youth. The average single adult in our programs is a 42-year-old man with at least two physical health conditions, at least two mental health conditions, and who has been using alcohol through intoxication for about 15 years. He has been homeless on average for 7.5 years. The average family in our program is headed by a 33-year-old single mom with three kids, average age of 10. She has two physical health conditions, one or more mental health conditions, and has been using alcohol for intoxication for about 6 years. She has been homeless on average almost 2 years. We think that given the untreated psychiatric distress and the chronic pain many participants endure, the drug and alcohol use may, in part, be self-medication. Our partners have an excellent record helping participants find and keep housing. In some cases, that's a site-based supportive housing community, like the Harrelson Apartments in Apple Valley, or the East Metro Women's Program in White Bear, or the Francis in Rochester. In these supportive housing communities, there are service staff on site to provide a range of supportive services. Most of our participants are living in private market, scattered site rental apartments or single-family homes. They get supportive services from staff who work out in the community. Over half of our participants get into housing in their first month in our program. Over 80% are housed by the end of their third month. 97% are in homes of their own after 1 year of enrollment. And I want to go back and make the point that these are single adults with 7.5 years of homelessness. These are families with 2 years of homelessness. And the vast majority of them were able to get into their own homes in 3 months. The people stay in housing. Looking at a subset of our participants who have been in programs for at least 2 years, 83% have been housed continuously for 1 year or longer, and 52% have been housed for 2 years or longer. These programs are funded through the DHS Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. The funding is very flexible. I was struck by that as I was listening to the previous conversation. This allows our supportive service partners to meet people where they're at and work on a very individualized housing plan. Someone with schizophrenia who's been living in a tent for the last 10 years might need some convincing that a home is a real option for them. Someone with a long list of evictions might have more limited options at first. A family might want to be in a neighborhood close to friends and family, or sometimes they want to get far away from where they live to escape domestic violence and others with addictions. The service staff help negotiate the lease with the landlord. They help identify a source of rental assistance. Many agencies offer some form of tenancy training to help people learn to be good tenants and good neighbors. We work with people to find housing first, but the whole time we're building a relationship, assessing a person's other needs, their strengths, and their goals. Many participants have undiagnosed mental illness. Many have significant disabling chronic health conditions that have been untreated and exacerbated by the experience of being homeless. I've heard the motto, housing is healthcare. As people move off the streets and out of cars and shelters and into homes of their own, they have an opportunity to attend to their disabilities through better daily care, like a good night's sleep and home-cooked meals, but also by establishing relationships with healthcare providers. Our service partners are there to provide whatever support someone needs to be able to get and keep housing and to attend to their health, chemical health, and mental health. I'd like to close with three thoughts. First, there are thousands of people with long histories of homelessness living outdoors and in shelters around the state today. Second, they have multiple physical and mental disabilities with a lot of co-occurring chemical dependency. Third, we know how to help them find and keep housing. Supportive housing works. Long-term Homeless Supportive Services Fund makes these services possible. If you tripled the size of this fund, you would see a dramatic reduction in the number of people with disabilities living on the street, and people would be living far healthier, much happier lives in their own homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have a question. You talked about the DHS program. What program is that?
Madam Chair, the Department of Human Services has a new funding stream that was created in the 2005 session. It's called the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund, and that pays for the supportive services tied to this Housing Plus Services supportive housing intervention.
And how is that funded? Is it a dedicated stream? Is it off the top money?
Madam Chair, it's general fund money. There's $7 million in that fund this year. There's $5 million in the fund next year. That funding goes out to regional collaboratives of counties and, in some cases, Indian bands. And then there's county subcontracts with local nonprofits in the Northeast, the Metro, and the Southeast and South Central with us, in Northwestern Minnesota with community action agencies, and in Southwestern Minnesota with a local mental health provider. And then we arrange for these supportive services linked with other funding for rental assistance so that we're kind of bringing the services and the housing together.
Questions? Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Very interesting. Okay. Next we have Jeanette Blankenship. Correct? Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here from Jeanette Blankenship from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and was asked today to speak a little bit about our programs for people with physical disabilities. We do also do plenty with people with mental disabilities. And there's a handout that should be in front of you that kind of summarizes what we do. My objective here is just to give you an overview of the resources that we have. And our agency, first and foremost, lends money to first-time home buyers, to new housing development, including single-family homes, multifamily rental, and supportive housing, such as the Total from the Heart Connection just discussed, and as well as housing rehabilitation projects. And we partner with counseling and lending and service organizations to connect people with housing opportunities. So I'm going to start with telling you about programs for homeowners and then programs for renters who have physical disabilities. And I'm not discussing today, but we do also fund long-term homeless initiatives, and many of those people, such as Ms. Host said, have physical or mental disabilities. So for homeowners, we have two kind of primary programs that actually you, Chair Amador, could have accessed, the Fix-Up Fund, which offers low-interest fixed-rate loans up to $35,000. And you must have an income below $89,000. However, that's waived if the improvement is being made for accessibility of a family member with a disability. Mm-hmm. And those, again, are low-interest fixed-rate loans, and the term varies depending on the situation. And the only other requirement is that you occupy the home or property to be rehabilitated. We also have a rehabilitation loan program which does come out of state appropriations, and it offers forgivable loans up to $15,000. And here the homeowner must not have assets that exceed $25,000 and have an income limit that does not exceed 30% of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area median income. So for a one-person household, that's $16,500. And a forgivable loan really is technically a grant unless they move out of the home before the term is up, and I think that's 10 years. So that's basically forgiven. And then for renters, like I said, we partner with a lot of organizations because we're primarily a lender. HousingLink is a primary partner for renters, and I have provided a website on there that is their online directory of affordable rental housing. And so on there, a person can look for whatever they need. They don't cover the whole state, but have a pretty robust database of current rentals, and I checked yesterday and it currently had 88 rental housing vacancies for people with disabilities in the metro area. And again, these are primarily for people for public housing or Section 8 or project-based Section 8.
Now, can you just explain to me what accessible, what is this group's definition of accessible? What does that mean?
It actually it provides a field for the landlord to enter in what the accessible is for their project. So I see ones that will say, you know, has a ramp entrance or has an elevator or includes bars in the shower. So they do ask that the landlord to specify. They don't have a definition that I've seen of what accessible is, but ask for the extent of the accessibility. So it's up to the landlord really to provide that clear information.
So there wouldn't be a universal definition for what accessible would be as far as if one, let's say, but more like in your area where Eagan Apple Valley, Burnsville have a lot of the complexes, if there were something in there, like if it has universal bars and elevator and a ramped entrance, that is considered accessible, where some other place down the road may just have bars in the back, and that would also be considered?
No, it is wheelchair accessible. They do make sure that if you look in the database, they have a wheelchair to show that it's wheelchair accessible, but you're also able to give the extent of the accessibility. So you're right, there's a baseline that you can enter and get around the property without on wheels. And then I was also asked to talk about public housing, which we don't administer really much funding to at all. It's a federal program through HUD. But they pulled the numbers and provided a website on there that HUD collects data on public housing residence characteristics. And the database can be searched by many different fields. I chose state and put in Minnesota. And as far as the disabled population, 40% in public housing in Minnesota is categorized as resident characteristics as having a disability. Broke that out into elderly and non-elderly, which is greater than the U.S. public housing total of 34%. And I think I skipped over one statistic I want to share as far as our rehabilitation loan programs. Since fiscal year 2002, we've done a little over 2,000 of those for all sorts of things such as furnace or roof or accessibility. And about 5%, we looked up, are made for acceptable changes, such as a ramp or bars in the shower. And with that, I'll take your questions. I do have, for you all, as well as anyone here, flyers that can give you more information on our programs for rehabilitation for homeowners.
Representative Dana? This may be just a tad bit out of the circle of discussion, but just out of curiosity, how closely does the organization work with realtors?
As a housing finance agency, we have partners that basically are our lenders, so we don't work directly with realtors, but folks who would be making, you know, the loan or showing properties would be the ones working with realtors.
I know my sister's a realtor, and I know they have, like, continuing education type things, much like attorneys do. Do you ever put on programs with, like, in conjunction with them about various financing options,
with specific to Sable community. I mean, I know a lot of this is non-for-profit or it's assistance in locating housing, but also that may be an avenue to pursue if we don't already do that. I'm not familiar, but I mean, just to partner with the realtors, because you know they're a wise group of people that understand too the market and the area, and maybe could be of assistance. And they're also a very charitable group that likes to help out with various programs. So I don't know if that's something that your agency has considered, whether it's with or the agency represents that whether it's with continuing education or maybe you know, just working together on some joint ventures about housing in the disabled community.
We do training, so I will be at, I'm sure we do it on all our different programs. So, for example, these fix-up funds would be part of that. But I will ask and get back to you if we have more information on that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we're moving Cindy Goudon. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Cindy Goodall. I'm with Heard Center's Community-Based Services. I'm the program director. We provide independent living skills, armed services, and relocation service coordination to about 460 individuals who are living in the community. Many of them have lived in nursing homes previously or are at risk for nursing home placement, and then certainly with the relocation services, we're providing services to those who are living in a nursing home. And just one other point, in addition to what my colleagues at the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living mentioned with 180 days, there are other forms of targeted case management that a person can receive while in a nursing home that will also start the 180 days. And it's not just the relocation service coordination. If they receive mental health targeted case management, that will start the 180 days. Or there's an adult protection targeted case management for folks with DD that also will start their 180 days. And it's been a challenge. We provide services in Hennepin County, and 3 years ago people got an hour or two of an assessment with mental health targeted case management and will start their 180 days, and then and the county is working with us to try to do a payback, and so we can provide the services, but it's been a huge problem for within Hennepin County. I know that they weren't aware of that federal regulation. So any form of targeted case management will start it. And that's a federal rule.
And the person, again, that starts that, it might be somebody at the nursing home or at your facility may say, I think we need to have an assessment here to rule out a condition, and that would start, even though they're not technically...
Well, or perhaps they were, you know, in the commitment process or something like that due to their mental health disability, and they received targeted case management, and at the time, the appropriate placement was in a nursing home, or they were an adult, you know, they had adult protection case open, and at the time they needed to go into a nursing home. Well, the case manager would see them for a little bit after they moved into the nursing home, and while they were providing that service and the county was billing, that started their 180 days. And the counties were doing that unwittingly, and they didn't know that that was the case, because now they're more careful about what targeted case management they will provide, or what they'll bill for. They have some mandates to provide some services, but it's that's also been an issue at the county level and for folks in nursing homes.
We'll be talking about that in much greater detail. I think we...
And it's unfortunate, you know, usually there's a crisis that leads them to the nursing home. They need to stabilize for a period of time, and then it's appropriate for them to find the community housing. But they need a little time to do that. It's not like they can always immediately start that process of moving out. Just one other thing I wanted to mention.
Thank you for that.
The main thing I wanted to talk about is in terms of finding housing, within our independent living skills program, we find housing for lots of people who are just sort of wanting to relocate to different housing, and maybe they're living with family members or something like that, or need to find more accessible housing. What we find is that affordability is the main issue for them in terms of accessing and finding housing. As you know, individuals on medical assistance have to be impoverished to receive medical assistance. And medical assistance is the only funding source for their support services to live independently and to live in the community, but also for their health care. They have very limited health care needs. And even if their Social Security income might be higher, they have to spend it down to 75% of the poverty level. And for a single person household, that's only $638 a month. So obviously market rate housing is priced out of their reach. So they rely on subsidized housing to find appropriate housing in the community. They can do that, you know, mostly through the Section 8 programs, either project-based or the vouchers through HUD, or there are some subsidies available through the state, the shelter needy money, or the DRH funding will also pay for some housing subsidies. But finding this affordable housing is often their key to either finding housing and moving out of the nursing home or maintaining their housing. A lot of people lose their housing because they can't lose housing and end up in a nursing home simply due to affordability issues, and they can't afford to live there anymore, get evicted because of non-payment of rent and have nowhere else to go, and so then land in a nursing home and oftentimes get stuck. So my point is that affordability is the main issue, and unfortunately, one of the big providers of subsidized project-based housing is the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. They provide through 41 high-rises 4,900 units, primarily for individuals who are seniors or disabled. And unfortunately, as of November 1st, they are going to close their waiting list and stop taking applications for folks who are under 50. And so that will pretty much just remove close to 5,000 units off the market for the group of individuals that Courage Center primarily serves, are the younger folks who have a disability.
Can you just give me an example of somebody who's under 50 that ends up working with your facility? What is the general, what does the average person look like, and what maybe brought them to your facility? Was it a new injury? Was it a long-term disability?
Well, at Courage Center, we have a transitional rehabilitation program, which primarily serves individuals with new injuries. So they had a spinal cord injury, go to an acute care hospital setting, and then come to Courage Center for more extensive rehabilitation, or had a brain injury, and then come to Courage Center. And the length of stay at our transitional rehab program is, I think, 3 to 6 months at this point. So then we provide the therapy services that they need to gain the skills and locate housing in the community. Or sometimes they return back to their own homes, or sometimes they're finding different homes that are more accessible. With my programs, our individuals are referred by their county case managers generally. So they kind of come from a broad range. Some have had more recent injuries and disabilities. Some have had lifelong disabilities. Some, you know, we oftentimes in our ILS program will have folks who maybe had a brain injury 15 years ago and actually did no rehab or anything like that, and just sort of floundered in the systems in and out, and, you know, finally were able to get on a waiver and to get some support services to stabilize them in the community. So, but, you know, for somebody who is under 50, you know, to try to find options for housing, the nice thing, too, about the Minneapolis public housing high-rises is that they are located in the city, so they have very good access to transportation, good access to support services coming into the home, or other kinds of support services that the person might like to go to, good access to jobs. It's a great housing option for many folks under 50 who want to, you know, lead a more active urban lifestyle. And now that's not going to be an option for them anymore. And, you know, there certainly is other subsidized housing in Minneapolis, but, you know, obviously the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority is a very big provider.
Thank you, Ms. Goodall. How many people right now, maybe you said this, how many people do the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority serve right now as far as?
The statistic that I found on the website was that they had 4,900 units of one-bedroom and studio apartments in their high-rises. So most of those one-bedroom units would have one individual in them. So, and they did say that their waiting list was close to 5,000 people, so I'm assuming that the reason they're closing it to that group is because their waiting list has grown so big with not that many units to be taken.
Thank you. So is Minneapolis looking to get more funds to add to the authority as far as having availability to it?
Representative Anderson, Madam Chair, I'm not really sure. I can't really speak for Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. I do know that they actually were very proactive with obtaining some mainstream vouchers for people with disabilities who are under 65, which are the Section 8 vouchers where people can kind of go to their housing of choice within the city rather than only to the high-rises. And they had applied for that, and those became available like last summer. But, you know, that waiting list filled up, and those vouchers are all gone now. They're not available anymore, and they don't take applications for their Section 8 voucher list. I don't know if they're planning to open that up. That would certainly be wonderful. But as far as I know, there isn't anything that's going to be replacing this for the folks who are under 50.
Madam Chair, I believe that Representative Karen Clark's committee, we're looking at the same type of situation, so that'll probably be another question that will be asked of Minneapolis authorities when and if we have a meeting and they come before our committee.
And it really does speak to the lack of availability of options for people, and that it's important to have options kind of everywhere for people so that they can choose the housing of their choice and what's important to them.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I don't see Mary Beth in the audience. Do we have a representative from Dakota County come? Right now, why don't we move into Ms. Cross's Universal Design, Margot. And just to let the audience members know, these are out in the back. Okay. There are two reports out in the back that I wanted people to have access to. One of them is a consortium publication on Priced Out, which talks about housing and the shortage of housing throughout. This is a U.S. report, but I think some of the statistics and the information they're talking about are very key to our planning here for services and housing for folks. And then the other one is it's actually a magazine talking about what it takes to build an accessible home. And some of this Margot's going to talk about right now, I think, and just give you an idea of what it takes in order for you to create a home that's accessible for somebody who may have, a new injury, maybe transitioning to a family home, similar to the situation I was in, and this checklist here. And I can guarantee you that when you sit down in your own home, if you were to take this home tonight and look at this, the cost for you to make your home accessible for somebody coming into it with a disability is it's mind-boggling. I know I sat with my head in my hands for a couple of weeks just trying to figure out how I was going to be able to do this for my home. So just welcome you to take a look at this and see what it would take for you in your own home to be able to do that. So with that, Margo, going to put yourself in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm Margo Linda Cross, and I'm the Accessibility Specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and I'm here today to talk about universal design and what's currently required in code and the various levels of accessibility. Universal design is defined in the following way. Universal design, which is related to inclusive design and design for all, is an approach to the design of products, services, and environments to be usable by as many people as possible, regardless of age, ability, or circumstance. Universal design includes such basic design features as a no-step entrance, wider doorways, clear floor space in the kitchen and bathroom. It then goes on to address other issues like equipment design, lighting, and appliances. The difficulty in applying universal design is that it is intended to accommodate everyone's needs. Universal design is a wonderfully ambitious goal, but unfortunately it's very difficult to achieve when user groups have competing needs and designers have their own individual ideas and priorities. Universal design needs to be better defined and more systematically applied if it is to be successfully utilized by the user groups. Currently in the state, we have three levels of accessible residential design and construction. They are visitable design, adaptable design, and accessible design. I want to talk about accessible design first because it's the highest standard. It's been required in state building code since the mid-70s. and it's required when a building has 7 or more units. It specifically requires that an accessible unit be designed and constructed so that it is accessible to someone using a wheelchair or someone with a similar disability. Each unit should provide a no-step entrance, wider doorways and hallways, accessible light switches, electrical outlets, thermostats, and other environmental controls, a lowered work surface in the kitchen, a bigger bathroom, a raised toilet, and grab bars installed by the toilet tub or shower. Those are the basic requirements of an accessibly designed unit. Okay? Adaptable design came into play with the Fair Housing Amendments of 1988. The amendments required adaptable design in new buildings constructed for first-time occupancy after March 13, 1991, with 4 or more units. The covered adaptable units have to be accessible by elevator or on an accessible route. The design requirements are intended to accommodate both individuals with ambulatory disabilities and wheelchair users, but to a lesser degree. Adaptable design requires, again, the wider doorways, no-step entrances, wider hallways, an accessible route into and throughout the unit, accessible light switches, outlets, thermostats, environmental controls. But in an adaptable unit, they put the backing in the wall for future installation of grab bars. There's no raised toilet, and there's only maneuvering space in the kitchen. There's no lowered work surfaces. So adaptable design is lower than accessible design and what it requires. And again, I think the intent behind adaptable design is that they were trying to reach a broader audience, and they weren't focusing so much on the wheelchair user. Although adaptable design doesn't go as far as accessible design, it is required in 100% of the units that are accessible by route or elevator.
Explain what route you have accessible by elevator or an accessible route. What is that?
Well, typically it means that you can get there without going up an elevator. You might have a ramp. It's on an accessible route, accessible path of travel. Ground floor units are typically on accessible routes. So if you can get to the unit either via an accessible route or via an elevator, then it's required to be adaptable.
Okay.
If you have a multi-story building that isn't equipped with an elevator, then those units above the ground floor would not technically have to be adaptable.
Okay.
Minnesota continues to require 2% of the units be accessible according to the definition of accessible that we just looked at. And that's in order to meet the needs of people using chairs and having a similar mobility issues. Although more and more adaptable and accessible units were being constructed, there continued to be huge voids in the housing industry where there were no options or very few options for people with disabilities. Single-family homes, duplexes, triplexes, and multi-level townhouses were generally not required to have any access features at all. In addition, during the 90s, many of us became acutely aware of the changing and aging demographics. With age, in many instances, comes disability and/or limited mobility. This included huge numbers of people who wanted more options and many who wanted to continue to live in single-family homes and/or townhouses. Many of the individuals didn't need full access, but clearly wanted a few access features such as no-step entrance, wider doorways, and a bathroom on the main level. In 2001, the Minnesota State Legislature passed a provision that required the above design elements, otherwise known nationally as the visitable design elements, to be required in the construction of single-family homes, duplexes, triplexes, and multi-level townhouses when Minnesota Housing Finance Agency construction dollars were being utilized. To date, hundreds of units have been constructed. That's the really exciting part of that law, is that hundreds and hundreds of units have been constructed, and that they have a no-step entrance, wider doorways, and a bathroom on the main level. And so many more people today have options. In order to continue to meet the needs of a changing, aging society, we need to continue to provide more options for individuals with disabilities, particularly age-related onset. In every community, we need to provide affordable, accessible housing across the continuum of design. We're currently exploring the possibility of changing the building code to require the visitability design features in building code, particularly for rental and specialist of housing. We'll see where our efforts take us. In the meantime, we do need to continue this discussion, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Anderson?
Design is still meets code and still meets the building construction code as far as for special needs of people that are disabled.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, absolutely. The accessible design, the one I just talked about, and the adaptable design are both included in code and are required when multi-unit buildings are constructed. Unfortunately, in building code, they fail to address structures that have less than four units. So if you have a three-unit building, a two-unit building, a single-family home, they're not covered by building code. They're not required to provide any accessible features at all. And that's where this legislature came into play in 2001 with the visitability requirement. Right now, those design requirements are only triggered when one is using MHSA construction dollars. And we did have some meetings this last session in an effort or an attempt to expand the definition and to attach it to more sources of money. There was some concern that it really should be in code. We'll see if we can get it in code. I have some doubts, but if we can, I would be thrilled, because that would mean it would apply across the board in every in most instances.
Mr. Cross, the visible design that you're talking about, that's not really, I mean, it's okay, but it's not the most advantageous for the individual.
Madam Chair, It's the lowest of the three. You know, if you had a hierarchy of design, you'd have accessibility at the top, adaptability in the middle, visibility at the bottom. And again, these all it's beneficial. It's clearly beneficial, especially to individuals with ambulatory disabilities and age-related onset. We're finding that a lot of individuals who are older absolutely love the design of the visitable homes, because, you know, they're provided with a no-step entrance and wider doorways should they need to use a chair periodically, or they might have a walker that they use or something along those. They're very and the bathroom on the main level, although I was talking to an architect and he said that the bathroom on the main level has become a market demand item, where they're building very, very few homes these days without a bathroom on the main level. So sometimes a weak bladder will speak for itself. But visitable is clearly beneficial, but it's, as far as serving the needs, it's only going to serve the needs of individuals with very limited mobility issues.
Madam Chairman, Ms. Cross, so the accessibility of for people with disabilities, you have a large need for that still in society or in the state of Minnesota, or are we pretty much with the code that we have in place from the state pretty much meeting the needs of those who are disabled, whether it's in a public housing situation like in Minneapolis or others in the building area? Are we meeting the needs for disabled individuals based on building code?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question. And I think a lot of the answer is almost a geographical answer, where your populations of persons with disabilities reside. In some instances, accessible units are very few and far between when they're in high demand in areas where you have all of your services, your supportive services, your transportation. Those types, you know, of that make it a very good living situation for an individual. As you move into communities where there are fewer services, fewer options, fewer transportation options, fewer service options, then you might have more of an abundance of accessible units available. It really does depend. I certainly think that in certain communities we could see a lot more accessible housing and it would be utilized. I think there could be a lot more accessible housing. And adaptable housing, the problem with the adaptable housing is that it automatically, it basically said that multi-level townhouses didn't have to comply with any accessibility requirements, and then we saw developers running out and building hundreds of multi-level townhouses. And so the accessibility or adaptability we would have gotten in a typical traditional apartment building wasn't there anymore, and those options weren't available to people. And so that's one reason we found it necessary to at least tie the visitability requirements into a funding source, so that at least if they're using tax dollars, my tax dollars, they're building something that I might actually be able to get into someday, which I think is only fair. I mean, if you're using... I think that's only fair. I think there are, in some communities we could clearly see more accessible housing. I think in some communities we could clearly see more adaptable housing. Visitable housing, I think, is a must just because of the aging of America and the aging of individuals in our community. I think that the visitability design standards could include a few more. I mean, it's only required at the time of construction. And there's a lot of things you can do to make a dwelling more accessible at the time of construction without raising the cost at all. You can move that electrical outlet from 9 inches to 15 inches, and it's not going to cost you a cent. It's just going to, the carpenter's going to have to, instead of just using one hammer blade, and that's how they typically gauged it, they just put it at the top of the hammer, and that's where the electrical outlet went. So let's make them do it twice. And you'll have, now you've got an accessible outlet. So there's a lot of things you can do with that aren't going to cost a cent.
Now, Jim, what I'm trying to get at is we are breaking the law in Minnesota with the way our code is situated now as far as meeting the needs of the disabled community. We don't have any outstanding cases against someone for the way the design of the building or something because of the need of housing, accessible housing for disabled individuals. There's no cases out there that you know of that there's a court case against somebody who didn't build it right or it wasn't built to meet the accessibility or the visibility or adaptability. Are there court cases that you know of right now in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, in Minnesota, and maybe I can ask Ann Henry to help me with that one. But actually, I don't know of any Minnesota cases. I know that there have been some other cases in other states where developers, I know there was a huge Chicago case not that long ago where there was, they built this apartment building and they made all of the doorways too narrow. And they literally had to go back in and replace all those doorways. And so I know that there are some cases throughout the country, but I don't know of any specific in Minnesota. And
is there anybody in the audience that can address that?
Thanks for that one question.
Yeah.
And we certainly don't want to get to the point where there is a law. Roberta, come on down.
Morning, Roberta. If you could identify yourself for the...
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roberta Oldtine, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities in Minnesota. I wasn't necessarily going to refer directly to a lawsuit related to building codes, but what I can tell you and what I've noticed throughout the testimony, when we talk about things like 180-day timelines and yet there's no housing, many of those things are in place because the intent is to force the system to develop what is necessary. And there's a major federal compliance issue around the issue of what's called the Olmstead Act, which requires us to develop facilities when there aren't any. In other words, people cannot stay or should not be staying in an institution simply because of a lack of housing and programming, and yet that's happening every day. People are not getting out of Anoka State Hospital, which means the ones waiting to come in cannot get in, and all of this relates to affordable housing. So there are a number of issues where I think whether it be the building codes or whether it be under the ADA or under the Olmstead that are in essence lawsuits perhaps waiting to happen. The problem is that for most of the people in the classification that we are talking about here have very little access or knowledge about any of the legal rights to pursue these issues and very little access to attorneys who will take these cases. So unless there's a major class action suit or something like that, we have federal laws, we have timelines, all designed to push states to create these things, otherwise this being in violation. But if nobody brings forward the lawsuit or the complaint about the violation, the system operates with inertia.
All right, thank you. I just have one more question for you, Margaret. You say 2% over here in the, that we require 2%. To be accepted. I'm trying, you know, without my glasses here, I'm sorry. Can you tell me, what? How many units does that equal?
Not a lot. It typically, of course, it's going to depend on the overall size of the complex. So if there's 100 units and we're looking at 2 units, again, theoretically, 100% of them or 98% of them are adaptable, 2% are accessible. Which means, again, that the raised toilet's available, the grab bars are in place, there's the kitchen is more accessible with a lower work surface, and so forth. It's but again, and it doesn't kick in until you've gotten 7 units in a building. So,
and just, we probably don't have anybody here at all that can answer that, but I'm just wondering how many buildings are being developed that are greater than 7 units.
Madam Chair, that's an extremely good question. I could call the Building Code Division and see if they can.
I think that would be great. And then how many are, you know, the 6? So it kicks in at 7, or is it 6? So it's the units that are 6 or fewer, or is it 7 or more?
Madam Chair, I want to say 7 or more, but I can verify that.
Could you do that and then forward that to my office, please, so we can? I will pass that out. I think that's interesting, given some of the numbers that we saw here in Ms. Henry's presentation of number of people that are receiving services and information we heard from Independent Living. I think that's an interesting number for us to get our hands around. So.
And Madam Chair, I will also contact a lawyer, Jay. What is Jay?
Who are you looking for?
Ann, Jay's last name?
Jay. Jay.
Anyway, Jay is heads up a team of individuals who go out every spring and look at accessibility and whether or not people are complying with the adaptable design requirements. And I'll find out if there's been any lawsuits recently that we should know about.
You could let both of us know that.
I would be happy to do that.
Well, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
The next testifier is Joel Uleman from the MS Society, and I'm very this housing project, I think everyone's going to be very interested in learning more about it, and unfortunately the length of time it took to come to be.
Madam Chair and member of the committee, my name is Joel Ulan. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I will have handouts coming once we get the PowerPoint up and running here. But what I wanted to do to kind of set up my testimony today is, first of all, kind of give you an overview of what MS is, because that will help to understand what the housing needs were for people with MS. Multiple sclerosis is a disease of the central nervous system. It is typically diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 40, and usually when people are in the prime of their life. There's no two cases of MS that are exactly alike. It can affect people quite differently. And so some people will be maybe diagnosed with the disease and have no symptoms, and some people within years, just a couple of years of their diagnosis, have very severe and progressive symptoms of the disease. And so what we do at the MS Society is we try to address all of these different needs. What I wanted to do today was talk about Kingsley Commons. And
we're having technical difficulties.
Yeah, not a problem. What I'll do is I have the handouts of my presentation, so we'll be able to just follow along from that. But what I would like to set this up as is that this is kind of a case study, I guess you could say, of how we tried to enhance the housing options for people with multiple sclerosis in Minnesota. And so what we did was we collaborated with a number of other organizations to build Kingsley Commons. And Kingsley Commons is a supportive housing project that is dedicated to people with multiple sclerosis. It is open now. It opened in June of this year and is located in the Lynn Bohannon neighborhood of Minneapolis, which is on the northern edge of Minneapolis. Just to give you a perspective of size, there's approximately 25 affordable and accessible apartment units that are located there. 18 of them are one-bedroom apartments, and 7 of them are two-bedroom apartments. As I mentioned, this was done in partnership. This was not just an MS Society thing. In fact, I would say that we weren't even the ones that originally started it. We worked with Powderhorn Community Council, and there were a couple of members that had multiple sclerosis or have multiple sclerosis that participate in that council, and they started talking about building housing for people with MS as early as 1995. And, they kind of kicked it around for a number of years, and then they met with us at the Multiple Sclerosis Society in 2001. And at that time, we were kind of going in our own direction of looking at, is there some housing things that we can do to address some of the housing needs for people with MS? And so at that point, we put together a survey of our clients, and that's where we kind of best understood what some of our needs were. After that survey, one of the things that became clear is that we needed to look at building some type of housing for people with MS. And so we started with an affordable and accessible building that we were going to build for people with MS. At that point, we worked with our third partner, and that was Common Bond Communities. And they did a lot of the development of the actual building itself. We also had to have a number of financial partnerships in order to make this project work, and thus becomes the challenge of the project. We worked with the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. HUD is a challenge. HUD is very good in what they are able to provide for us because they were the most significant contributor to the project as far as both capital dollars to actually get the project off the ground, but then also the rental assistance in order to for people who, once they move into the building, they will pay no more than a third of their income in rent. And that is a very important key, so that way we aren't financially draining people once they move into that building. There's that cap. And so that is something that HUD was able to help us out with. But the negative side of HUD would be is that there is an unbelievable amount of paperwork that you need to do and regulations to follow and obscure little things. And it was a real challenge. And I think for our organization in particular, this was a challenge because, you know, certainly Common Bond Communities, this is something that they do. They're familiar with that. But from my own organization's perspective, as far as we're just trying to get more housing available for people with MS, this was a challenge. It seemed like every few weeks we were getting another twist and turn on something that we never even knew existed. But to go on with our financial partnerships, we also collaborated with Hennepin County. Hennepin County provided us some grant dollars for the project. The City of Minneapolis, the property was originally owned by the City of Minneapolis, and so we were working with them on this as well. Obviously, my own organization participated in this, not only in just helping to set this up, but I'm also very proud to say that our organization contributed $600,000 to the capital investments of actually getting this project off the ground. So we were frankly willing to put our money where our mouth was on this project. We also were able to seek 4 additional corporate grants for this as well. So why did we do this? Well, as I mentioned, we did this survey, and it really identified what some of the housing needs for people with MS were. And as we started to get this project going and started to market this to our clients, I think an interesting statistic that we had was that between the years of 2004 and 2007, there were 500 people with MS who expressed interest in this project. Keep in mind, we had 25 units. So I think that was very telling. Now, quite a number of those people probably, frankly, did not qualify for the building because their income was not low enough to qualify for the income qualifications that HUD would have for this. But just overall, to just have that many people expressing interest shows the need that is out there. Another important point was that 73% of people with MS who responded to the survey indicated an interest in congregate housing specifically designed for people with MS. What this means is they wanted to live with other people with MS. And I think that this is also an important statistic. I think the members know, I also co-chair a coalition of disability organizations. And one of the things that many of our organizations value is the fact that we want to make sure that people have choice in housing. And choice can come in a variety of ways. Choice can come in making sure that people have access to housing out with people who don't have disabilities. But I would also say that in this particular instance, choice meant that people with MS could also be with other people with MS. Now that the building is open and we've had people there, one of the comments that we've heard from people is, finally, I'm with a bunch of people who understand what I'm going through and understand what MS is all about. And so this was an important issue for us, is that we wanted to be able to have a building that would serve people with MS. I will also kind of move on to the original vision of the building. The original vision is that, frankly, quite different from what actually was built. The vision was that we had a task force that was developed in 2001 and continues to meet, and to look at what it is that we wanted. What we wanted was a 49-unit building. We wanted 45 of the units to be rental housing, 25 of them would be HUD subsidized, the remainder would be market rate. And then we also wanted 4 market rate condominiums to be available as well. We also wanted to make sure that there was 24-hour, 7-day-a-week support services available. Another component that our committee wanted was respite care options, so that if a person wanted to stay just for a weekend or something like that and help out if they're living in their own home, that there would be that option. And then the final option was that we wanted an adult day program to be a part of that building, so that way it would not be just for the people who live in the building, but it would be another way for people from outside the community to join in. Now let me come back to my earlier point about dealing with HUD. That just wasn't going to work because of the HUD rules. And there was a variety of reasons for that. And so, to kind of go with that old song that you don't always get what you always want, this certainly was the case here. But I'm very proud of what we've been able to build because it certainly has been very successful for the people who have moved in. We are seeing that there's a number of people who are living independently and being able to meet others. I think one of the things that we also heard from people with MS that have moved into the building was that they felt very isolated before, and now they're with other people, and so that has been a very positive outcome. Another outcome is that we do have one person who moved out of a nursing home and was able to move into this building, and we also had a person who was in an assisted living facility who was able to move into this building as well. And so I think all of those are positive outcomes and certainly were part of the dream of what we originally had with this. So to kind of summarize on my last two slides, I wanted to talk about what are some of the unmet needs that continue to exist and that we continue to identify through this process. First of all, as has been mentioned before, there's little stock as it relates to affordable and accessible housing. It's very challenging for us to continue to find that. And I think one of the things that this process brought out for us is, as I mentioned, we could only serve 25 people with this particular building, but we worked with quite a number of people just through the application process, and when we were trying to determine whether they would be able to even meet the application guidelines for this, and realized that they didn't, when we tried to find other options for them, frankly, there's not a lot of other options that are out there in the community. So that continues to be a challenge. I think from my own organization's perspective, we have another challenge as it relates to people with MS. Many of people with MS, because they're diagnosed in the prime of their life, they do have income and they do have assets. And what that often means is that they get easily disqualified for things because they don't have enough money. When we've done surveys of our population, it roughly splits into a third and a third and a third. A third of our people who are at poverty or below, a third of the people who are above the poverty guideline, not by any means rich, but, you know, they don't qualify for a lot of government programs, health care and or otherwise. And then a third of our population is, frankly, financially well off and not hurting in that particular area. But I think when you look at a disease such as multiple sclerosis, and I think that this carries on throughout other disabilities as well, is that there are a lot of hidden costs to having a disability such as multiple sclerosis. And so a lot of people, they on paper, they don't qualify for a lot of these programs. But by the time that they've paid out all their co-pays and all their extra things that they need to pay for services, in a lot of cases, they're more financially worse off than the person who is at poverty and qualifying for the government benefits. And so, you know, I think one of the things that we've been trying to steer our course toward is what can we be doing for that middle third, you know, the third that just doesn't qualify for anything. What we've been trying to look at is condominium as options. You know, what are some of the options that if a person with a disability can't continue, or a person with MS in this case, can't live in their own home, how can we steer them to a market rate condominium where they can at least take some of the assets and the money that they have within their own house and be able to invest it in that way and not have to drain their assets in other ways. I think the final, or the other point I'd make in unmet needs is that the government needs to encourage innovation as it relates to housing. This is an innovative project. It's not to say that it's completely unique, because there certainly is many other projects that are out there for people with disabilities, but it certainly was unique in serving people with MS. But we had to clear quite a number of hurdles. As I mentioned, all the different levels of government, you know, they don't all collaborate with each other, as much as that sometimes may be a surprise. It's difficult to do that. And I think that we deal with the challenges in multiple levels. It's not just in the housing authority level. It's also in, you know, in the case of what we had to do with this building, we were trying to line up the medical assistance services, because we anticipated quite a number of people would be on medical assistance. And so I'm trying to anticipate that CADI, you know, the CADI program, the waivered programs under medical assistance, and making sure that those would be available. That was a challenge for us. The other part that I'd say as far as the government connection is the transportation piece of this. Making sure that there is affordable and accessible transportation in that area. Now, certainly that was one of the reasons why we picked Minneapolis, was we were in the core area. But I think as you look at where a lot of housing is being built for people with disabilities, a lot of it is in the third ring suburbs. And yet there's no connection between the housing that's being built over here and then the Met Council's plan over here as to where they're going to provide Metro Mobility Transit services and how many hours a day those services are going to be. So that continues to be a challenge as well. And my final slide is that lessons learned. Being patient is not a virtue. It takes way too long. It took us 5 years to build this, and we only have 25 units to show for it. And I'm really proud of those 25 units, but I have a whole list of other people who need to be served in this. It takes too long to be building these types of projects. The systems of government must be able to better communicate, as I mentioned before, and be more creative in how we serve this type of population into the future. And I would argue that the legislature and others need to take a systematic approach to identifying what is the housing needs that are out there? I'm not sure that we, certainly there's been reports that have been out there, and I know the Options 2 report that is out there, but I'm not sure if we truly know what the game looks like as far as, if people with disabilities had their ideal world, where would they live? What kind of setting would it be? I think a lot of times we're trying to put a square peg into a round hole, and it doesn't always work. So with that, I would answer any questions.
Representative
Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ewing, for your testimony. One-third below poverty, one-third at poverty, and one-third well-off. Is that of the 500 or 5,000 names that you mentioned on the previous slide?
Representative Anderson, to clarify that, we've done numerous surveys within our organization. One of them was related to housing. Others are, program surveys that we're doing, on behalf of our own organization. And that's been a consistent theme that's come. And so I would say that represents our 9,000 clients that we have with multiple sclerosis in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Kingsley Common, the land that was purchased there for that to sit on, is that considered in your financial situation? Does the HUD program just only for the building, or does it help? Do they help with purchase of land, or how does that all work out in relationship to building this facility?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I will start my answer with that and saying that happened about 3 or 4 years ago, so I'm maybe a little fuzzy on that particular answer or that detail, but the way that I understood it is that the money that was raised through HUD could be used for the purchase of the land and then building upon it.
Well, Madam Chair, I agree with you on the feeling about the systematic approach by the legislature. I think that once you've gone through this 5 years, we're able to shorten it to at least 2.5, and after you've gone through it a couple more times, we ought to be able to get it down so that whatever it takes to build that thing and make that process so it works, and if it's been proven and it shows that the system works that way, but it doesn't seem to work that way, does it?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, no, it doesn't work that way. I mean, I think that as I was preparing for this testimony, I was thinking that there was probably about two or three separate occasions where this project could have been torpedoed by various levels of government because there was, something wasn't connecting with how they wanted their process run. And, and so that's just from the government perspective. I also just have to throw in a very brief story is that it should be noted that when we took bids for this project, the bids came in the first week of September of 2005. You may remember in the last week of August was Hurricane Katrina. We literally had people, that were writing their bids and rewriting them in the lobby of our developer because of construction costs. And so there was a number of amenities that we had to cut out of this project simply because of Hurricane Katrina. It was quite a process. And the government certainly had a role in it. It wasn't exclusive to that. But it's very challenging to put together this type of project. And anybody, I think, can build a building. That's not the part I'm arguing. I think what we did, though, is we wanted to make sure that it had the amenities that would meet the needs of people with MS. And those amenities, some of them are very cheap, as Margo mentioned. Some of them, frankly, are not. And that is part of what needs to be kind of built into the process. If we're going to be building new housing stock, which I think is certainly needed, we need to make sure that there's enough flexibility in how the money is distributed for this to make that happen.
I'm looking forward to hearing from you next month as we can explore this issue of poverty and how we force people into impoverishment and how that has affected your membership as well. But thank you very, very much for this. And
yes.
I'm actually looking, I probably am going to call and I'd like to take a tour of this.
Okay.
It's my own self-interest.
Not a problem. We can make that happen at any point.
Thank you. Okay, we have one last testifier here, Judy Worrell. Excuse me. Yeah. I really should just leave these on. That's all I'm going to do. Thank you. If you can just identify yourself for the page.
Good morning. Thanks so much for this opportunity to meet with you today. I am Judy Worrell. I work as a critical care nurse at Hennepin County Medical Center in the Level 1 Trauma Intensive Care Unit. But more importantly, I am the mother of a daughter with disabilities who is 20 years old. Our daughter's disability is related to an illness she had as a 9-month-old. When she began to recover, we soon learned that our little girl was left with some significant neurological and cognitive deficits. As she is entering the time of her life when most of those in her age group are pursuing their independence, she is dependent on those of us and her support system to make her life and give her opportunities that we are taking for granted. I'd like to address the lack of funding available to assist her and many others like her in their pursuit of appropriate housing. I'm sure we would all agree that everyone is entitled to choose where and with whom they live, and also that our constitutional and civil rights are violated when anyone is denied housing access. In many cases, denial is in the form of unavailable funding. I believe this breakdown is directly related to a huge knowledge deficit within our legislative body regarding this need. Allow me to please ask you what may seem an odd question. Where is your house key? I am confident each of you know exactly where your house key is because you do indeed have a home. For most of us in this meeting, the process of living in our own home, the home we chose to live in, has not been fraught with barriers, and certainly most of us have not faced the barriers with which those with disabilities encounter. I became painfully aware of these barriers and lack of resources when we began setting 1, 2, and 5-year goals for our daughter when she was 18 years old. We were feeling a sense of pride to be such proactive parents. And we learned very quickly that because she did not have a waiver, her options to resources to live in safe housing with appropriate supports are unavailable to her and are virtually non-existent. As I have been aggressively networking, leaving my employment, trying to educate myself in available options, I have found our story is in no way unique. There are over 5,000 people in Minnesota waiting for DD waivers. And in my networking, just about the time I'm thinking a waiver would be our fix-all, I'm now learning that there is yet another significant population of those with disabilities that do have waivers, but are disqualified from necessary funding because they are not, by definition, in a situation that would likely produce an adult or child protection issue. I have attached a copy of this guideline to my testimony for your review. Now, wait a minute. Do you feel a bit incensed? Is the message from our legislators, you have got to be in a crisis or just short of being in need of adult or child protection before there is any housing funding for you? This is an outrage. Allow me to leave you with this one visual symbol. I'm asking you to take 2 of these ugly little balls, and I am respectfully requesting that you place 1 of these balls on your desk. And when you see it, please be reminded of its symbolism. Imagine a house key within the ball, but getting to the key is encumbered by many barriers. Barriers such as uninformed policymakers who do not pass meaningful funding legislation, and add to that restrictive guidelines. The many layers of tape represent a visual and virtual puzzle of where to begin. Another representation of this ugly ball is that there may or may not be a house key within. Although these symbolic ugly little balls are not intended to be opened, in reality, as I have learned from others, a person with a disability could potentially work through all the barriers and face a dismal reality that even though some of the barriers are overcome, there is still no house key to be had. This is indeed a harsh reality and a cruel journey for our people with disabilities. I ask you to please give the second ball to another legislator, but please choose one whom you believe is uninformed on these issues. Take the time to educate them on the critical issues and ask them to place this ugly little ball on their desk as a visual reminder to this need. Ask them to stand with you in creating and voting for legislation that provides funding for these needs. Generally, we place things on our desks that we choose to showcase. And this ugly little ball is not a work of art, but meant to be a symbol of the frustrating, encumbered process to attain housing. Madam Chair and Representatives, a state system that may, for many, does not have significant housing funding except when a threat would like to produce an adult or child protection issue is an embarrassment, and certainly not a system ready to showcase. I close in thanking you for giving me a platform to speak. None of us want our efforts to be an exercise in futility, and so my appeal to you is to be vigilant and an agent of change to educate other policymakers and empower them with knowledge on these housing needs. And finally, please listen to our lobbyists on these issues and seek out their wisdom for solutions. And please, please be instrumental in expediting and passing meaningful legislation that places appropriate funding in these areas of need. Thank you.
I just have to tell you, you know, I don't need a little ball on my desk. I have a picture of my two kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think in your letter here and in your testimony that I don't think very many people understand what we're under. You know, when our children are born, who are born, and we expect to be following a path, and then all of a sudden our lives change and we go down a different path. And I'm not going to recite the Holland poem. Those of us that get it, no, we don't want it anymore. I don't want tulips. But I think that it is important for us to help other people understand that our issues of independence with our children are not so simple as get a job and go out and find a place to live. And for you to be encountering housing issues with a 20-year-old, and I'm sad to say you're probably going to be encountering them for many, many years to come. I'm in that same situation. And even right now trying to plan for college for my daughter, where is she going to go? What is she going to do? My options are significantly limited, even though I have a child who shouldn't be in that position. So anyway, I personally just wanted to let you know I appreciate what you're doing, and I'm glad that you're here today.
Thank you. And if I might add just another personal word that wasn't in my testimony, my awareness of the lack of understanding of legislators was based initially on an individual who I sought counsel from in pursuing various avenues of resources and influence for this need, this housing need. And the individual with whom I spoke is probably one of the more intelligent, actually I would say most intelligent person I know. This individual is very bright and has had a direct access to former governors and is just brilliant in the legislative process. And a comment that he made to me, Madam Chair, was, I'm sorry to say that there is little interest in issues with people with disabilities because they don't vote. That is not true, and how was I to begin an educational process with him that I should probably stop right now, but you understand my point. And this highlights to me and drives home to me that there is a desperate need for our legislators to be educated on this, because it's not because they don't care. I didn't know the need before we came into this having a beautiful daughter with these needs. But now, I'm learning that people just do not know.
Well, that's the goal of this committee, and I hope to help to educate that and to bring your passion on this issue is the same passion that we have here. So thank you very, very much. Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson, hold on just a second, please.
Thank you, Ms. Worrell. Thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing us the waiver process is a big thing that needs to be changed. Again, it's getting back to the systematic situation of what Mr. Ewing was talking about, and not only in the federal, but in the state government, and I think that's a huge one. I think once we find a process by which we can show and prove, I mean, I have a daughter that's been disabled since birth, and yet the paperwork that I go through just to prove on a monthly basis that she's still disabled,
mm-hmm.
It's ludicrous. It really is. And I sit in government, and it's the bureaucracy I see in both the state and the federal government just, well, it keeps jobs that don't need to be there, because I think there's people out here that need our help, and we keep just building government. We forget about the people that we need to help. So thank you for bringing forward this, and I hope that we can pass on these little balls to the rest of the legislature.
Maybe Representative Anderson, you and I should sit down and have our party once a month to do that paperwork. Between the two of us, we've probably filled out every form.
Great.
It was absolutely. Well, I'd like to also let people know there are copies of this test form.
On the back?
Folder. Oh, and the folder. We do have some written testimony here that we'll be reviewing as well. And next month our meeting is on poverty issues, and in particular the fall into poverty once you get a medical diagnosis. I encourage all of you to, if we can't put you on the agenda, to please submit a written testimony regarding this, and your stories if you'd like to share them. And I just want to let Ms. Laurel know that this is not in vain, that this is. We are taking this seriously here, and there are legislators here that care, and we will be addressing these issues. We will be. So thank you very, very much for coming, and this meeting is adjourned.